You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 18th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's programme, India heads to the polls tomorrow for a six-week-long election. But is it already a done deal for Narendra Modi's BJP? We'll preview the start. After that, we'll have the latest business headlines. We'll look at Germany's arrest of two German-Russian saboteurs. We'll bring you the second part of our special Spring Global Countdown. And finally,
we have a similar ambition as all of us in Narendra, which is making the world a little bit better, project by project.
We'll head back to Milan to join Monocle's team at Salone del Mobile. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. Tomorrow marks the start of the world's largest democratic exercise as Indian voters head to the polls in a six-week-long process that, if the prognosticators are to be believed, will hand Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party an unprecedented third consecutive term. Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP remains the country's most popular force, though critics would say their popularity has been aided by some underhanded tactics targeting the country's media and opposition. Well, joining me now is Maya Sharma, a journalist based in Bangalore. Maya, welcome back to the program. First of all, tell us how Narendra Modi himself has positioned himself in the last month or so. What's his pitch?
Well, he has been traveling around the country, across this huge, enormous country, despite the heat wave on in many regions, 40 degrees plus in many areas. He is definitely the face of the BJP. He is presenting himself as the absolute leader. He's talking about Modi guarantees as the biggest selling point for his party in his bid to come back to power for the third consecutive term. He is attacking the Congress. Much of the campaign of the BJP is about attacking the opposition, including the Congress and other parties, saying that they failed to deliver on many fronts. It has been in many ways a negative campaign, saying what the country suffered under the initial years of Congress rule, although he has, of course, been in power for the last 10 years himself. It's been a very, very volatile campaign indeed, marking, of course, the incarceration behind jail. Many of the opposition leaders are, in fact, in jail, including the Delhi Chief Minister, Arvind Kejriwal, which we talked about last time. He's still in jail. No bail for him. And in that way, Prime Minister Modi is going ahead, going around the country. Of course, campaigning has stopped for the 102 seats, which will be voting tomorrow. Campaigning stopped yesterday. There is a two-day silent period. But he seems all set to try and take on the electorate and get back power in June when the counting happens.
Well, Maya, as you mentioned there, the last time that we spoke on this show was after the arrest of the opposition leaders from the AAP party that governs New Delhi itself. There is this united opposition alliance, but how has that impacted the opposition coalition more broadly? What's their role at this point? Who's kind of taking the lead?
Well, any coalition, of course, does have its ups and downs. But I would say that over the past few weeks, the opposition, the known as the India bloc, has been able to get its act more or less together. They are working as a team, except in some states like the southern Indian state of Kerala, where they are fighting against each other for power. But elsewhere, they've been able to present a united front. They're talking about the common themes together. Their biggest thrust, really, has been the decline in democracy, what they see as a decline in democracy in India, the targeting, of course, of opposition leaders, of themselves, of party accounts being frozen, leaders being put into prison. But they're also talking about an attempt to divide the country, an attempt to actually make communities fight against each other. They say this divisive politics is what really marks the BJP, and they're using that a lot. They're also attacking the government on issues of unemployment. Unemployment figures in India are uncomfortably high. They're talking about inflation. They're talking about corruption behind electoral bonds, which was a rather dubious method of funding political parties. They are taking on the government, the ruling party, on those fronts. And they have been able to present a more or less united front in the last few weeks leading up to the voting itself.
Well, I wanted to touch on the economy, but before we get to that, this democracy aspect that you say the opposition is raising, how successful has that been? I mean, it's something that we also focus on, you know, outside of India, but is it reaching through to voters? What are their main issues that are making them passionate about this election?
Well, unemployment is a huge factor, and many people are finding it very difficult to manage with inflation and trying to keep pace with the rise in the cost of living. But unfortunately, I think in many ways, this whole debate on democracy is restricted, as often happens elsewhere in the world as well, to social media. The people who are complaining about it may be talking echo chambers. They may be preaching to the converted. But there is definitely a point being raised, at least on social media, and in some of the increasingly shrinking number of media houses who are ready to take on the government, talking about the decline in democratic values in the country of India. That is an issue. I'm not really sure if it's resonating with the person on the ground who is concerned about his or her income, the food, the money they're getting for the crops they're growing. I think the economy is really a bigger issue for them. But Narendra Modi, of course, presenting figures saying that things are much, much better under the NDA rule, that is the coalition of the BJP and other parties. He's saying that they have done much better than the Congress-led coalition which preceded them.
Well, that's what I wanted to get into when it came to the economy as well. What is your sense there, too, of how voters are feeling? There are sort of multiple sides to this, aren't there? Because India's economy in terms of growth is doing very well. It has grown to become the fifth largest economy in the world. But as you mentioned, unemployment is particularly high. So what is your sense of whether Modi will be rewarded for his handling of the economy?
Well, I think India, perhaps more than any other country in the world, it's a place where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. The bulk of the wealth is concentrated in the top few percent of people. I mean, the rich are getting enormously, almost obscenely rich, if I could say that. And there are charges of crony capitalism also against Prime Minister Modi and the BJP itself, that the government in power has been favouring big, big corporate houses in terms of allotting them contracts, in terms of maybe even twiddling the laws a bit to make it more, to make their businesses more profitable. That is, of course, a huge charge. And definitely the middle class who may have been seeing their investments grow in the stock market, who've been seeing the growth in their savings, may think we're onto a good thing here. Why rock the boat? Let's let Modi come back. In casual talk, you hear people saying invest now because after the election, the market's really going to go even higher. But that is the sense among the middle class and among the wealthy. The poor, again, surviving day to day, are hoping for jobs, are hoping for some kind of relief from the difficulties that they are facing. And whether they'll take that concern to the ballot box, well, that's really the 970 million voter question.
Just finally, to follow up on that, Maya, quickly, you almost give the sense there that Modi is not that particularly popular. I mean, if there is something then that you would focus on to say why he is going to get a third term, what is it?
He has been stressing on the whole Hindutva concept, the whole feeling that Hindus, the Hindu majority in the country, is in danger. He has created an enemy among the minorities of the country and saying that they are perhaps, I mean, well, he of course denies this. He of course says he isn't. But there is a perception that the BJP is actually dividing the country along religious lines and that by trying to consolidate the Hindu voters into a feeling of we are there to protect you, we are there to keep you safe, that may be playing on the minds of many voters who feel, yes, we need this kind of protection. We have in the campaign, we've seen BJP leaders firing imaginary arrows at a masjid. We've heard hate speeches against minorities. We've seen all that. We are still witnessing it in the campaigning itself. So that could be a way he is reaching people. He opened that huge Rama Mandir, the Ram temple, back in January. And in fact, just yesterday, it was Ram Navami, the celebration of the birthday of Lord Rama, observed by many Hindus. So he's tied up religion a lot with his campaigning, with his politics. And that does seem to be working in many areas of the country.
Thanks very much, Maya. That was Maya Sharma. Now here's Carlotta Ribello with today's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. The Israeli Prime Minister has warned that his country alone will decide the nature of any retaliation for Iran's attack on Saturday night. Western countries have pleaded for restraint. The United States, the European Union and the G7 group all announced plans to consider tighter sanctions on Iran, seen as aimed at trying to pacify Israel. The United Nations Security Council is expected on Friday to vote on a Palestinian request for full UN membership. Israel's ally, the United States, is expected to block the request because it would effectively recognize a Palestinian state. And Croatia's long-dominating ruling HDZ party has won the country's parliamentary elections, but without a majority. They prepare for difficult coalition talks with the far-right party Homeland Movement as potential kingmakers. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Carlotta. Now to the latest business headlines with the head of investment at Interactive Investor, Victoria Scholar. Victoria, thanks very much for coming onto the show. Let's start with EasyJet. Their shares are getting a boost today because demand is doing pretty well, although there are, of course, flight disruptions like so many airlines for Israel.
Yes, that's absolutely right. So EasyJet is hoping for a strong summer for travel demand. This, of course, is typically their most popular season. And it's also forecasting a smaller than expected loss over winter, which tends to be at the time of the year that it finds itself in the most difficulty in terms of demand and also sales and earnings. But consumers in Europe clearly continuing to prioritise their summer holidays, even at the expense of other spending amid pressures from the cost of living crisis and elevated interest rates. But EasyJet said it is confident that it can deliver another record summer performance, which is why the stock is trading sharply higher, extending recent gains. But there are still concerns, like you say, about disruptions to travel in the Middle East. EasyJet has cancelled flights to Israel until October, just this week. And that, of course, follows a ramping up of geopolitical tensions. And EasyJet says that it's reallocating into destinations where it sees stronger demand going forward. So places like Malaga and Mallorca, as well as other holiday hotspots in Portugal and Amsterdam for city breaks.
Just to follow up on that quickly, Victoria, I mean, do you get the sense that this is something specific about how EasyJet is doing with its demand, or is this also feeding through to other airlines?
No, I think we're seeing it across the low-cost carriers. And what's been interesting to see is that the likes of EasyJet and Ryanair and others have been raising their prices amid the inflationary background, with costs going up from everything from wages to energy. But consumers still seem to be taking on those extra prices. They're not deterred by the fact that even the low-cost carriers are becoming more expensive. So it shows that consumers aren't willing to let go of their precious holiday plans.
Well, let's focus on one other story, Victoria, for today. We're getting results from another company, Netflix, later in the afternoon. What should we expect from that?
Yes, so all eyes on Netflix because it's kicking off earnings season in the tech sector. So it could give us some clues into how some of the other tech giants might fare this period. And the stock's had an impressive run lately. It's gained about 30% already this year. I think the real focus is going to be on subscriber growth figures, because in the last two quarters, the streaming platform has enjoyed stellar subscriber growth. And that's because it's been clamping down on password sharing. So it managed to get 22 million new subscribers in the second half of last year. But that tailwind could start to fade now because a lot of those extra subscribers have already been counted. So we're looking at new subscriber numbers of somewhere around 5 million, which is still pretty strong compared to the year before. We'll also be looking at the performance of how its cheaper ad-supported tier is holding up. This is something that it introduced to try and battle cost of living pressures and encourage people not to switch off their streaming accounts. And now about one in three new signups do subscribe to that ad-supported model. So that's going to be certainly something to watch as well.
The tricks of the trade for subscriptions. Victoria Scholar, thank you very much. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Chris Chermak. For the past few months, much of the talk around Ukraine has been whether Western support is waning or being undermined, and whether Russia is gaining the upper hand. Well, in Germany today, two German-Russian citizens were arrested for trying to actively sabotage Western support and aid for Ukraine, including a possible plot to attack US military facilities. One of the men was allegedly fighting for pro-Russian separatists in the Donetsk Republic all the way back in 2014. Well, joining me for more on this is Stephen Diao, Russia analyst and regular Monocle Radio contributor. Stephen, good to have you on the program as always. These two men face a whole range of accusations. What do we know about what these two men were planning?
First of all, I think it's important to point out that they are dual nationals. They both have Russian passports as well as German passports. There are a lot of dual national Russian Germans living in Germany, so that shouldn't surprise us. But they've been named without surnames. So there's Dieter S. and Alexander J. That's all the Bavarian police have told us so far. Dieter S. is the one who, as you mentioned, it seems fought in the Donbass on the Russian side between 2014 and 2016. And he's accused of plotting an explosion, of being in contact with Russian military intelligence. And Alexander J. Is accused of much more recently assisting Dieter S. and helping him to identify potential targets, which the idea is that between these two, they would go and blow them up, places like US military facilities in Germany.
Now, this is going back to rather old school spying and sabotage, frankly. I mean, to what extent do we imagine that Vladimir Putin's regime itself could be involved in directing this?
Oh, I have no doubts at all that they're involved in directing this. I think that one of the dangers in recent years, as we've become digital societies and everything is online and so on, and we assume that intelligence is entirely something that's done on the dark web or with electronic means. There was a thing that years ago they used to talk about in the army as human intelligence, and you still cannot beat human. Someone on the ground who can actually go and have a look at something, even with a satellite can see certain things, obviously from space, but it can be quite easy to hide things like military equipment from a satellite. Whereas someone who's actually on the ground, who can actually see it with their eyes, who can take photos. I mean, that's one area where things have developed, where everyone now has a camera on their phone. So you don't have to have a secret camera. It's very easy to take pictures without anyone realizing on your smartphone. And so this human intelligence, this human, is still of vital importance. And Mr. Putin, as a trained spy himself, and all of those around him, know the value of this. So I have absolutely no doubt that that they've set these men up to this, and others too. I think this could be the tip of an iceberg.
Well, that was going to be my next question. I mean, if human intelligence is this crucial once again, what is your sense of whether, even if the public perhaps is not as aware of this, whether the West, whether the German authorities, US authorities, how aware are they? Were they caught off guard by this? What are they kind of doing to try and counteract some of these efforts? Are we ready for this kind of old school return to spying and sabotage?
I hope and I think that our security services in particular are aware of this. They realize that this human intelligence has never gone away. And I think the fact that the Germans have announced that they've arrested these two men is a sign that that they are aware. They know this still goes on. Incidentally, there's a case also in Austria at the moment, a man called Egisto Ott, who was arrested at the end of March and has accused of spying for Russia. So, you know, there's another little bit of the iceberg, as I say. So I have no doubts that this is going on, but that our intelligence services in the West, and I hope to a certain extent our police forces also know about this, that governments know about this, and they will be doing as much as they can to try and combat this.
And Stephen, when it comes to the rhetoric side of this, I just wonder what your take is on, I mean, particularly in, say, Germany. It's not as if this spying and sabotage isn't entering fertile ground. There is a debate within Germany. There are those voices who are either pro-Russian or, let's just say, not as willing to support Ukraine and kind of turn Germany's economy upside down for this. I mean, how do we imagine that stories like this, arrests like this, will kind of enter that debate? Do you expect that in countries like Germany, too, that there will be this, you know, looking over everyone's shoulder at this point for who's responsible, who's supported by whom?
Germany is crucial in all this. Germany is Europe's single biggest donator of aid to Ukraine. Germany is currently leading a plan to send more air defense, including American-built Patriot air defense, which is the best, to Ukraine. And it's become particularly crucial because, of course, this impasse in Congress in the USA, where they've been waiting 6 months to approve a huge aid bill for Ukraine, including military aid. So while that's happening, and that may be resolved this weekend, we will see, something to look out for. But in the meantime, Europe is doing its bit and Germany is leading. And it's a very interesting case because when the war first started in February 2022, there was a lot of opposition in Germany to opposing Russia. Since the breakup of the Soviet Union, indeed just before that, so the late 80s, 1980s, German business moved into Russia in a big way. They took advantage of Mikhail Gorbachev's perestroika and glasnost and moved in. And they built up huge contacts. Germany has more contacts, business contacts in Russia than any other country in Europe as well. And the business lobby in Germany was actually pretty vociferous, and also indeed behind the scenes as well. There was even more fuss going on about what Germany should be doing in the war with Ukraine on Russia's side. Finally, they actually, you know, they did succeed in winning the day, and Germany has been giving this aid. But it doesn't mean to say that those business interests, and indeed those with the dual citizenship, those who are actually Russian, have gone away. And so I think the German security services will be working overtime to try and stop more of this. And as I said before, I'm sure that this is not a unique case.
Stephen Diao, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And now it is time for another special edition of The Global Countdown. Today, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaks with Tom Edwards about the selection of spring music highlights that are set to be added to the Monocle Radio playlist. Let's have a listen.
You are listening to The Global Countdown on Monocle Radio, and it's the second part of a special springtime two-parter, Toe Tappers, music to fit the mood, longer evenings, early summer sunshine, that kind of vibe. Our Fernando Augusto Pacheco is the man tasked with bringing the sunshine. Faye?
And good vibes.
Sunshine and good vibes. Now, keen-eared listeners will recall from last week, we set a very nice tempo. It was synthy. It was easy. It was upbeat. Is it more of the same this time around? Tell me what's informed your selections.
More of the same. In fact, the first song we're going to hear, it's funny, this band, because it is a vibe in itself. There's a lot of kind of instrumentals. It's very gentle. It's perfect for, you know, a dinner party. It's spring, you know, you can serve your guests outside, hopefully. I love this track, and I think they are very creative. It's funny because our last artist last time was Beyoncé, and I said that, you know, she grew up in Texas. And I believe this band, they are also from Texas, and also very much loved, especially by people here in the office. It's Krungbing. They have a new album, A La Sala, and if I may say, people should buy the new Monocle issue. I wrote a review of their album, A La Sala. But let's have a listen to Pom Pom by Krungbing. I like it. You know, it is a vibe. And you know what, Tom? I need to go to Texas now. There's so much like interesting musicians coming from there. I think next time I go to the US, that's definitely on my list.
Incredibly interesting and diverse music scene, seemingly.
Absolutely. Definitely need to go there.
Okay, so a few Texas stars from the Lone Star State. Who do we find at number four, though, Fernando?
Something completely different. We're heading to Hong Kong. And in fact, this song, I have to say, was inspired by David Stevens. I know he did a special selection.
And it's not often you hear that.
He did a special selection of music for our Chiefs Conference in Hong Kong. So, of course, there's been plenty of artists, a lot of canto pop. And this lady we're going to hear, she's a 76-year-old lady and she's iconic. She's a great actress. She won several awards, but she's also a musician. So we're going to hear some elegant disco from Hong Kong, I believe from the late 70s. So we do like to add some old tracks as well. This is Dini Ip with King King Tan. It's so good.
That is old, proper old school.
King and Tan. Wow.
Good stuff. That's powerful 70s, late 70s disco vibes.
Thank you, Dave.
It's my kind of era.
Yes. Well, I wonder now, because the next track, again, I like that today, actually, the songs are very different to each other. Are you a big fan of Finnish Afro Trap?
I mean, Faye. clear the way. Let me through. Absolutely.
Maybe I've scared you a bit, but this song is amazing. It's a new song from Finland. It's been topping the charts there. It's by two of the biggest names in Finnish music at the moment. I was talking to our, you know, late Markus Ippi. Don't worry.
He's not late.
He's still alive.
Our former colleague. Yes.
Our former colleague, yeah. Markus Ippi.
He's very much still alive.
He's very much alive. He's also a big fan. This is Ege Zulu and Ben with Tunista Tuntin. Tarvin apua nopein. En puto moneen, mut sä sait must oteen. Tunnista tuntiin on niin kävä sua. Etkö sä miettii edes ikinä mua? Nyt aika valoo vaan. It's
that
groovy.
Was Faye. Faye was clicking his yes. fingers there. I think you might have heard that, listeners. So what are we talking? Finnish trap, something?
So he's a big name in Finnish Afro trap. I mean, it's a big scene there in Finland. And Ben, she's a more popular pop star, you know. Okay. So and I think the combination between both of them makes a perfect hit for the spring.
Okay. I'm just letting that one sink in for a moment. You've thrown me slightly there, Faye. Where have we got up to? Was that number three or number four?
That was number three. And I'm going to throw you again.
Because we are going all over the shop. What have you got at number two?
It's crazy. It's another old track from Brazil, this time from the mid-80s, which I think is... I love the mid-80s in Brazil. Because, of course, we had a little bit of bossa nova, but we had the Brazilian New Wave movement as well. And I think the combination of both... it was perfect. Some people might say slightly cheesy even, but I don't think...
Surely not one of your selections, Fernando.
Yeah, I don't think he's cheesy. He's Vinicius Cantuária. I mean, I think not many people outside Brazil would know him, but I think they should. And that's why I've added to the playlist. It's a lovely track. It's called Só Você, Only You. Let's have a listen.
So give me a sense, Fernando. What would Vinicius there? What was he? Is there a video that goes with that track, or what would he have been rocking? Was it some like folded up sleeves and a bit of that action?
Absolutely. And the cover of that album is amazing. There's a lot of kind of reds and purples and a bit kind of, I don't know. You can't really see his face. It's quite mysterious. And the track says, "I hug you and few things I can say." It's just, yeah. If you're in Ipanema Beach in 1984. Listening to this track.
I might have been there.
And having a caipirinha in hand. That's the vibe. That's the vibe I want to project here.
Good beachside vibes. And it's good because that is taking us, that's nudging us even beyond spring into early summer, which I like, throwing it forwards. Look, we've reached the end of our 2-part, 10-track springtime countdown. Who do we find at the top of the freshly blooming tree?
You know what? You mentioned to me that you like the 70s. Don't worry, this is a brand new track. It just came out. but it feels very 70s in a way. But also, this band is quite interesting. They're from France, Papoose, but they speak English amazingly, so you wouldn't even know that they were French. And again, they are touring.
Always a benefit.
I don't know. Yes, they're touring around Europe at the moment. So there's some touches of a little bit of bossa nova, a little bit of 70s rock from the US. So a lot of amazing influences as well. I want to hear your take on that. It's Papoose, It Hurts Me. Misinterpretation of your silence at the end of the phone. Distracts me from your love. You can't feel
it. I like it, Fernanda.
Yeah.
There's some kind of maybe a little bit of Debbie Harry vibes going in there, this kind of thing. I see what you were getting at.
Absolutely. I mean, and who doesn't love Debbie Harry, right?
Faye, good selection. I can scarcely... Maybe it's just a lack of familiarity. I've not been in the Global Countdown chair. Maybe because I've had a bit of a breather, I've lost some of my critical faculties. But I think a really nice mix. And I'm delighted that we're going to hear a number of the tracks from this week and last week through the playlist. If people do tune in to Monaco Radio Live and hear more of the music, any other little gems in there that maybe you couldn't fit into these that people should be listening out for?
There's plenty of gems there. I think we've been adding a lot of Japanese music. I think that's... Even the J-pop market, I think people should find out a little bit more about that. It's not just K-pop. So I think if you look at Japan, there's a lot of new artists and, of course, some old city pop classics as well.
Check it out, people. Fernando, always a delight. Thanks for bringing us up to speed with a two-week special of the Global Countdown.
That was Monocle's musical curator, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, in conversation with Tom Edwards. And finally, on today's show, we head to Milan's design fair, Salone del Mobile, where Monocle's Europe editor-at-large, Ed Stalker, caught up with Marius Meeking, the director of product design at Snøhetta. He started by asking about the kind of products the award-winning Norwegian architecture practice were showcasing at this year's fair.
This week is quite special, as every year. For us, in our product design department this year, we're launching three special projects for us. It's our first collaboration with Fornace Brioni, with handmade terracotta tiles and 3D objects to be played with. We have also expanded our collection and collaboration with Lotus, now increasing the volume collection into an entire collection. Also now with standing lights. And we have a very special project of ours, our first collaboration with MDF Italia. And this system is based on the brief of challenging what comfort is. Now, challenging the whole ecosystem and understanding that, how that is from production to end of life. Each module has been developed with an injection molded core that functions almost a little bit like a Lego system. So with these unique Lego pieces, you can create an entirely modular configurator and play with the system and play with comfort, ease, how to actually plan spaces, plan different situations. You can make it smaller, bigger, but also each material is detachable and can be exchanged.
What's the best thing for you? Is it coming to see what other designers are up to? Because I know some designers say they don't like to do that. You know, some designers we sort of talk to like to operate almost in a vacuum. They'd rather get inspiration from somewhere else. Well, that's what they say anyway. And then you know, seeing other designers, and it's more maybe the conversations, the debates, seeing if people are on the same page. What's the best thing for you from this week that you take away when you go home?
I think actually being here together with my team, together with the rest of Snøhetta. We've been up to 25 people from Snøhetta here this week.
That's epic. That's a lot of people.
Yeah. Being able to be together in this kind of slightly different setting is really, really rewarding. Obviously, also meeting old friends, new friends, and being face to face. We always talk about that when people meet, things happen. And this week is really a testament to that.
And when it comes to the product design, do these often go into Snøhetta's own projects? How does it work? What's the relationship like with the architectural side?
What we aim to do is really to leverage the experience and context of Snøhetta, being able to utilize all that expertise that we have in our different studios. Now, by utilizing that, we can make sure that we are fairly certain that the projects that we do will have a meaning, will have a future, and taking in that bigger picture into the thinking when we're developing these products that will have an impact.
Okay, so there's kind of bold ambitions, and obviously, you know, it sounds from, you know, what you've been talking about earlier that you've got lots of projects on the go, and although you were talking about being in the city centre and being in sunny Milan, you know, I presume there's also putting a business hat on as well and going around the trade fair and potentially finding new clients to work with as well in the future.
Obviously, it's finding people, I would say. People that we feel we have a connection with, that we share ambitions and goals, and that we feel that we can do something exciting with. For us, it's important that we have a similar ambition as all of Snøhetta, which is making the world a little bit better, project by project. To do that, you can't do it in a vacuum. You can't do it alone. You have to have really good collaborators and dreamers that you're working with.
You talked about making the world better. How does that feed into your product design? Obviously, there's big talk all the time about circular economy, sustainability, yeah, ownership versus whether you can borrow. Like, these sorts of big ideas that invariably get discussed at places like Milan Design Week. How does that feed into what you're doing? How are you striving to make the world better? Is it about using different products, different materials that are more sustainable?
I mean, we are in the lucky situation that we get to work on a high variety of types of projects. Now, for us, any project that we do has the ambition of making a change, and it has an opportunity to make an impact. Now, sometimes that may mean a small impact, but an impact either way, or it may mean an actual small leap that really pushes something forward. It's hard to judge or know exactly what that will be in the beginning of a project, but by pushing ourselves and our collaborators, we hope that we can reach more meaningful projects that have the future in mind. Now, one project that is a good example of this is our Fleet Pavers, which is a very weird project for product design studio to do if you weren't in the context of Snøhetta. Now, suddenly, working with landscape architects and architects, understanding the urban environment in a new way, working with our partner there, ALSAK, to develop new solutions that are functional in today's challenge and tomorrow's challenge with flash flooding, we were able to build basically three pavers working with an industry that hasn't been doing a lot of innovation in many, many years, and introduce something that could be a tool that that actually could create an impact. Now, since this was launched, we were a little bit uncertain how meaningful will this be. But once we launched this, it has gained incredible interest, and this fairly small Norwegian company, ALSAK, now we're helping them with discovering global licensing deals and getting it out there, getting it global or locally manufactured. And suddenly this thing that's on its own, a concrete paver, can be an incredibly sustainable, regenerative business model that actually has an impact on the environment.
That was Monocle's Ed Stalker in conversation with Snøhetta's Marius Meeking. And that's all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Tamsin Howard. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.